I don't know if you've been like me, that you've taken a car in to get fixed and you pay a bunch of money and you get it back and you're driving away, or maybe a day or two later you find out that it really didn't get fixed. Has that ever happened to any of you? I think it's a pretty common experience, and I think it accounts for the fact that there are actually TV ads advertising the qualifications of mechanics. Like, you've heard of Mr. Goodrich, right? And the GM certified mechanics. And considering everything that James has been through for learning to be a Volkswagen mechanic, it would give me confidence now if I had a Volkswagen to take one in to get it fixed. I think, really, when it counts, you need somebody who has proven competency, when it counts. And I think that's what accounts for licenses for doctors and dentists. It sort of comforts me to go into the doctor's office and see the plaque on the wall and see that he really does have a license. And in fact, nurses and dental technicians have them. And, I kind of like sitting there looking at the dental technician's plaque before she starts digging on my teeth, And so, there's quite a few professions that have those licenses that are proof of a minimum level of really a pretty high level of competency. You really want your lawyer and your accountant, even barbers and hairdressers have licenses. And so, when it counts, you want someone of proven competency. Well, how about in the spiritual realm here at church? Our pastor has some pretty impressive credentials, so much so that the denomination has ordained him. And if you've ever talked to him about what it took to be ordained, you'll find out that that was no small accomplishment. He's got to have a college degree in ministry, years of service, and after he's completed these two requirements, he goes through an extensive examination that took years to complete of doctrine and ministry, and they even examine his personal life. And there's no one else here that comes close to having the qualifications for ministry that Don has. So he ought to be doing all the ministry here at church, right? Right? Well, in fact, that's wrong. And the Bible says that it's you and I that sit in the pews, we're the ones God has made responsible for doing all the work of ministry. He actually has no responsibility. And you might be saying, well, what's the deal with that? The guy that's most able has, we who are not so able have all the responsibility, and the guy that's most able doesn't? And this will make sense when you think about the Cornhuskers. They're going to take the field here in a few weeks and play some games. And early on in the season, they're going to play one of the best teams in the country, University of Southern California, national championship 2-3 years ago, played for it last year. And you're going to see that the guys who know the most, who are the most knowledgeable, the best prepared, will never leave the sidelines. They're called coaches. And, they're directing people who are less knowledgeable, and they're preparing those people. And that's Don's role and the role of the elders. And what's happening is that God is demanding that we take the field. He's put the ball in our hands. It's up to us to move it up the field. And, I think a lot of us are kind of afraid of that, of having the ball put in our hands. Maybe we're really not completely sure what to do with it when we get it, and we're afraid of fumbling it. And, we think maybe somebody else would really do a better job than we will. We just feel like we're inadequate for the task. I think a lot of us feel that way. Well, let's see what God has to say about our adequacy for the task, for service for Him. Open your Bibles to Exodus chapter 3. And we'll start in reading in verse 1. Now, Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and lo, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. And when the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I. Then he said, Do not come near. Put off your shoes from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, I have seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them out of that land to a good land, a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring forth my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? Basically, Moses is saying he's not qualified. You know, who am I? And this is really a pretty good question. What qualifies him for this supremely difficult task? Well, let's look at the facts. First, Moses was once in line to be king of Egypt himself. And now he's herding sheep. In modern terms, this would be like being in line to be CEO of a Fortune 500 company, only to end up digging ditches. Basically, you know, he was something once, he's nothing now. He's a has-been. Also, when this happens, he's 80 years old. You know, and you'd kind of think that by, you know, he's been herding sheep 40 years by now. And you would think that, you know, by the age of 80, you know, he'd have a few sheep of his own, maybe move up into management, have some sheep under, some shepherds under him. But he's hurting for his father-in-law, his wife's dad, for Pete's sake. You know, I think you could probably say in Moses' case that there's nothing he's ever tried that he hasn't failed at. You know, he's a loser. Really. He's a loser. So what qualifies him? Nothing, right? Right? Well, that's wrong. God responds to that in verse 12. God said, But I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought forth the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God upon this mountain. What qualifies Moses for this supremely difficult task is God's presence. You know, God's not too concerned with Moses' lack of qualifications. In fact, to God, this is already a done deal. God is not concerned about whether Moses is able to do this or not. His lack of qualifications are not a hindrance to God. So Moses moves on in verse 13 to his second objection. Then Moses said to God, If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, The God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, What is his name? What shall I say to them? Now, this is a good question, too. And Moses brings up several objections, but this is probably the best. And it's so good that God spends more time answering this objection than all the rest put together. So what makes this objection so good? What's he really asking here? You know, he's talking about God's identity. And what this really isn't about is names. What this is about, his question about God's identity is in terms of God's character. He's asking, Who are you really, God? And we'll look at some facts again here from Moses' point of view. It's been 430 years since God has communicated with the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So where has he been? Look what's happened to them in the meantime while he's been gone. They've become slaves in Egypt. And, you know, from Moses' point of view, you know, the going's gotten pretty tough in Egypt, and God has cleared out, and, you know, he's being sent to confront the king of the most powerful country on earth, and it's guaranteed that the going's going to be tough. So can he really count on God to stick by him and help him out when the going's going to be hard? You know, and as, you know, God has identified himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, God made promises, three promises repeatedly to those three men. And those promises were for descendants, for land, and for blessing. Well, there's descendants over there in Egypt, but they don't own a square inch of ground. And as for blessing, for Pete's sake, they're slaves. You know, one out of three is not very good, is it? So, you know, Moses is basically saying that, and, you know, he doesn't really have confidence in God sticking by him. And I thought I'd kind of rework this question that Moses is asking in a super polite way. I thought I'd just put it how I think he's really saying it. Now, when I come to the people of Israel and say, the Lord, God of our fathers has sent me, what am I supposed to say when they say, big deal, so what? He hasn't cared about us for 430 years, and we can't believe anything he says anyway because he doesn't keep his promises. What am I supposed to say then? You know, this question really attacks God's character, and I think that's why God spends so much time answering it. And God answers it three times, and he begins in verse 14, and this is how what he says in answer to this question. God says to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. So he's saying God is who he is. He isn't one way today and another way tomorrow. He's the same way all the time. God doesn't change. He's not capricious. And I think I think nearly everybody kind of sees God as capricious. You're not really sure what God is going to do. But God's saying he's the same way every day. He's the same in the past, the present, and the future. He goes on to tell Moses some more. In verse 15, God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered through all generations. So, I think what God's saying is here is how he represents himself is how he really is. So, he's emphasizing he's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Well, who was God to these three men? I think, first of all, he was a protector to them. You know, they were sojourners, travelers, all of their lives, all three men. And they lived in places that were dangerous for them. They had neighbors who were enemies or neighbors who were jealous of them or opposed them one way or another. And yet, God protected them all repeatedly from their neighbors. God was a provider for all three. All three became rich and powerful. And it was clearly through God that that happened. And, you know, the whole thing with Joseph and Jacob and his family going to Egypt, that was about God providing for them. God was powerful for all three. All three of them saw God perform miracles on their behalf. And God was steadfast for them. He wasn't there one day and gone tomorrow. Whenever they needed him, he was there for them. So, you know, he was a protector, provider, powerful and steadfast. Well, God has more to say in verses 16 and 17. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, The God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have observed what has been done to you in Egypt, and I promise that I will bring you out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. And then he goes on to tell what's going to happen. And the next few chapters of Exodus are really just fill out this paragraph. But God is saying here that he really does care and he really does keep his promises. And he's referring specifically to those two promises that haven't been kept, for land and for blessing. And he's saying that he is bringing them to the land. And when they go, they're not going out as slaves. They're going to take the wealth of Egypt with them. They're going to come out rich. They're going to be blessed. Now, this question about having confidence in God, I think, is really critical. You know, if Moses couldn't believe that God was going to be in his corner, I don't think he could ever have proceeded on to Egypt and confronted the king of Egypt. And, you know, it's okay if you're really not qualified for a task and it turns out well, but if you try something really difficult and you get hung out to dry because you get deserted along the way, that's a whole nother thing. And I think that's what a lot of us are afraid of, is if we get into a situation where we're, you know, service to God, where it becomes difficult and we get in trouble, you know, and God just leaves us there. I mean, who's going to take a chance on that? No one will. So I think, you know, God really wants to convince him and us that he is with us. He won't leave us or forsake us. And the question is, do we really believe that? Well, Moses moves on to his third objection in chapter 4, verse 1. Moses answers, but behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, the Lord did not appear to you. Well, basically, Moses is saying he has no credibility. And he's right. He has no credibility. He has no credentials. I mean, why should they listen to him? He hasn't been around for 40 years. He hasn't helped share their sufferings. And when he was there, he was on the other side. Why should they listen to him? Well, this is no obstacle to God either. And God gives him some credentials. We'll read here in verses 2 to 9. The Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? He said, a rod. And he said, cast it on the ground. So he cast it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses fled from it. So it wasn't just any serpent. It was a dangerous, scary serpent. But the Lord said to Moses, put out your hand and take it by the tail. So he put out his hand and caught it, and it became a rod in his hand, that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Again, the Lord said to him, put your hand into your bosom. And he put his hand into his bosom, and he took it out, and behold, his hand was leprous, as white as snow. Then God said, put your hand back into your bosom. So he put his hand back. And when he took it out, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. If they will not believe you, God said, or heed the first sign, that they may believe the latter sign. And if they will not believe even these two signs, or heed your voice, you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and the water which you shall take from the Nile will become blood upon the dry ground. Well, God gives him some credentials, credentials so good that it can't be ignored. And so, lack of credibility was no obstacle to God. Now, years ago, when I just got out of college, I was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the church I went to there, one of the chaplains at the state penitentiary went to my church, and one day after church, he cornered me and he said, you know, I've got a cell block there at the prison where they're locked up all the time. And he says, I just haven't got time to go from cell to cell to visit everybody. He says, I think you'd be great for the job. Show up tomorrow night after work, and I'll meet you at the gate and get you started. And I told him, well, I'm going to be younger than anybody there. And they're all you know, probably a lot of them are a different race, and, you know, I've never really been in any kind of trouble. What can I tell them about being in trouble? He says, you'll do fine. And he says, you know, there's some bad things that could happen to you out there. But he says, I really don't think it'll happen. I don't think you'll have any troubles at all. So I went out there on Monday night and for a whole bunch of Mondays that followed. And I was amazed to find how well received I was. And, you know, except for some good-hearted ribbing, I never received any trouble at all from those guys. They would listen to me and were glad that I was there to talk to them. And I was in total amazement the whole time by that. Well, Moses has a fourth objection. And this is in verse 10 of chapter 4. But Moses said to the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, either before now or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue. Now, basically, Moses is saying he's ungifted for the task that God has appointed him to. And, you know, he's right. In the real world, you want somebody who's going to be a spokesman, and Moses knows he's going to be God's spokesman. You want a person who's eloquent to be a spokesman. And I think he's kind of pointing out to God that, well, while you've equipped me to do some miracles here to give me credibility, have you forgotten something? You know, I need to be a better speaker. You know, you could kind of help me out right now with that. And basically, God brushes that off. You know, lack of ability is not an obstacle to God. God answers him here in verses 11 and 12. Then the Lord said to him, Who has made man's mouth? Who makes him dumb or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now, therefore, go and speak, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall speak. In fact, God's sort of telling him that he made him on purpose to be inarticulate. You know, it's kind of a mind blower if you think about it. Why would God make his spokesman be inarticulate? God is completely aware of his limitations. This is kind of another sports thing. Have you ever heard the phrase, it's better to be lucky than to be good? I mean, sometimes teams that aren't so great that are really lucky will beat a good team. And I think God's basically telling Moses here, it's better to be inarticulate if your words have presence than to be a really good speaker. You know, God says he's going to be with Moses' words. His words are going to be powerful even if they're not articulate. You know, I think we often feel that the response of other people to our ministry, to their response to God, is kind of up to us somehow. That if only we were a little more skillful or more persuasive, that somehow people would respond better to God. You know, we know our limitations, don't we? And I think we somehow, in our minds, we believe that our limitations somehow limit God. And, you know, God is saying that isn't the case at all. And if you take, he's giving Moses as his example to us. And if you look at Moses, until Jesus Christ came, he was God's greatest spokesman. You know, this is nothing to sneeze at. God's greatest spokesman probably had a hard time putting a sentence together. You know, we need to get it in our heads that our limitations don't limit God. I want to say something about gifts of the Spirit here, too. You know, I've heard people use their lack of giftedness as an excuse not to serve God. And I think we tend to maybe mistake that our natural abilities for gifts of the Spirit. And while I think natural abilities can be gifts of the Spirit, ultimately the gifts of the Spirit are supernatural. They're what God does beyond what you yourself can do. You know, and if you think about it in those terms, how would you know what your gifts are unless you try things that you really aren't good at? I just want to urge you to take a chance once in a while. Go out on a limb. Try serving God in some area where there's no reason to think that you have any ability at all. You may just find that you really have a gift there. Using myself again as an example, when I moved from Santa Fe, I went to Bible college. And I think, you know, the experience with the prison, I probably figured I'd never try anything as dangerous again in my life. And so I one of the things I did when I went to Bible college was that I ran for president of my class. And to my astonishment, my classmates elected me president of our class. And, you know, I didn't have any reason to think, I'd never been in charge of anything before that, really. And one of our professors told me once, he thought I was one of the best class presidents that the grad class had ever had. And, you know, and I kind of have found myself in charge of things ever since. And, you know, I would never have found out that I had anything possibly in this area of my life if I just hadn't, on a lark, given it a try. So, you know, go out on a limb once in a while. I also want to say something, too, about lack of ability versus spiritual readiness. You know, lack of ability, I don't think it really concerns God at all, but I think God's really concerned about spiritual readiness. And if you look at Moses, when he was 40 years old, he tried to do something in the service of God, and it came out disastrously. And God put him on a training program, herding sheep for 40 years. And when this interview with God takes place, you know, he's 80 years old. He'd been herding sheep a long time, been in that training program. And, you know, I think he learned a thing or two about things out there herding sheep. And I think it doesn't say in the Bible, but I kind of think he learned to be a man of prayer out there, you know, talking to God, because he didn't have anything else to do, and he learned to talk to God out there. And when God appears to him, he was spiritually ready. So I want to encourage you all, there's opportunities for spiritual training here, and take advantage of those. You know, work hard at becoming consistent in prayer, and work hard at getting to know your Bible and how to get something out of it. You know, work hard at becoming obedient to what your Bible is telling you to do. And, you know, the time will come when you're spiritually ready. And I want to say, too, do what the coaches here, Don and the elders, tell you to do. I think you may find occasionally that you want to be out there on the field and you find they're kind of hindering you from that. And probably more than likely, they don't feel like you're spiritually ready. But when the time comes when you are spiritually ready, I think they recognize it, and they will be doing just the opposite. They'll be trying to push you out there onto the field to serve God. And, you know, coaches make mistakes once in a while. You know, don't do a Harrison Beck and get mad and leave. You know, do what they tell you. I think in the end, you know, Harrison Beck, he's going to sit on the sidelines for the next year or two anyway, and it will not have helped him at all. And if you get mad at the elders and Don and leave, it's not going to have been a help to you anyway, I really believe. Well, Moses comes up with a fifth objection, and that's in verse 13 of chapter 4. And this is what he says. But he said, "O my Lord, send, I pray, some other person." And I ask myself, what motivates this? Is he just afraid? I mean, you know, he really does have a death warrant waiting for him in Egypt if he goes back. He committed murder there, and he goes back, he's going to be caught and punished. Is he afraid of failure? You know, he was a has-been, is a has-been. It's a nobody, it's a loser. Is he worried that it's going to be hard? You know, he's going to have to move. He's going to pull up all of his roots. He's going to have to do something he's not used to doing. He's going to be doing things he's not good at. Is this motivated because it could be unpleasant? You know, he's been told he's going to confront the king of the most powerful country on earth. I mean, that's got confrontation's tough anytime, but that's got difficult written all over it. You know, churches everywhere have people sitting in the pews that aren't doing things. And, you know, what motivates that lack of service? I think it's usually fear. You know, this is one of the things I really love about our church here is there's everybody contributes. But even so, I think there's reluctance in our hearts for virtually all of us. And I want to read to you God's response to Moses' unwillingness. And that's verses 14 to 17. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, "Is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he can speak well, and behold, he's coming out to meet you, and when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. And you shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you what you shall do. And he shall speak for you to the people, and he shall be a mouth for you, and you shall be to him as God. And you shall take in your hand this rod with which you shall do the signs." Now, this is a very interesting response, I think. You know, first, it made God angry that Moses was unwilling. And amazingly, he does what Moses asks. He does send someone else. But he sends that other person as an assistant. And, you know, if you read on, you find out that whenever Aaron is not with Moses, things don't go so well. You know, he wasn't that great an assistant to Moses. And finally, Moses is not let off the hook. And, you know, I think probably there are people here who have been feeling like God has been wanting them to do something for a long time. And, you know, you've been saying no to God for a long time, but he doesn't quit asking. He doesn't let you off the hook. You know, maybe it's time to say yes to him. You know, with my family leaving here, you know, we're shaking things up, I know. We have our hands in a lot of things here, and there's going to be a lot of holes that need to be filled. And, you know, some of you have already stepped in and started filling those holes. And I've heard comments from some of you that are doing that you really don't feel up to the task, that you're really not qualified. And, you know, a few weeks ago, Chuck, in July when he was preaching, he asked me if I wanted to take one of those to say something, you know, any final words. And I've been thinking about it ever since. And I asked to preach this because this is what I want to say to you is what God is saying through this passage. It doesn't matter what your qualifications are. God can use you. He is with you. You need to believe that. There's no limit to what you can see God do. And I think he's just simply looking for people who are willing to try what only God can accomplish. You know, there's opportunities here all the time. You know, pull out the stops. Try something you're completely unfit for. And I think you may see God perform miracles just like Moses did.